Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I have an exciting Buddha story for you this morning. It's kind of grisly and gross. So I know you'll find it entertaining. This is a story from the Dunkaroku, the record of the transmission of the light, which was a series of lectures given by Keizan Jokin, who is considered the mother of Soto Zen. Dogen is considered the father of Soto Zen. So Dogen started Soto Zen in Japan. He lived from 1200 to, I believe it was 1252. Keizan was a third generation from Dogen, and Keizan really propagated the school. That's why Keizan's called the mother of Soto Zen. And Keizan founded the Sojiji Monastery, which is kind of like the Sojiji and Eheiji are the two big training monasteries in the Japanese Soto Zen lineage. Keizan Jokin, who lived from 1268 to 1325, gave these 53 transmission lineage stories as lectures, and then they were later written down. So they start with Shakyamuni Buddha, and they end with Edo, who is Dogen's primary disciple. So this is a story of Upagupta. Right? Upagupta is the fourth patriarch from Shakyamuni. Upagupta was a really well-known teacher. He was quite successful in causing others to come to awakening. And he was so successful that he garnered the attention of a demon who wasn't very happy about his success. So this translation is by Francis Cook, and I think he does a pretty good job, so I'll just read this to you. The demon, resentful, watched for a time when Upagupta entered samadhi. So he was sitting in meditation and having a deep meditative experience. So then the demon, exercising all of his demonic powers, tried to harm the true Dharma. So how did he do this? The venerable, while in samadhi, saw what was intended. The demon watched and secretly hung a garland around Upagupta's neck. So this would be a garland of flowers. Doesn't sound very, disruptive. But anyway, Upagupta noticed. So he had this idea, Upagupta did, he had the idea of subduing him, subduing the demon. Rising from samadhi, he took the dead bodies of a human being, a dog, and a snake, and he transformed them into a flower garland. So, speaking softly, he put the demon at ease. So he goes up to the demon and he speaks to him very softly and kindly. Upagupta, this great teacher, talking to the demon, seducing him in a way. Because the demon's fearful, right? The demon's like, what's up with this? So Upagupta says, "You offered me a very rare and wonderful garland, and now I have a garland that I would like to offer you in return." The demon was very happy and extended his neck to receive it. Dun, 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 dun. Then the garland changed back into the three smelly corpses. Ooh! Insects and worms crawled from them. The demon detested it and was greatly distressed. Like, duh. Can you imagine? There you are, this guy who's in, who's a great teacher of the Dharma that you kind of annoyed, brings you this garland and says, "Oh, I've got a special gift for you. You're going to love this." He puts it on you and it turns into these smelly, disgusting things. So the demon couldn't get rid of it despite his supernatural powers, nor could he unfasten it or move it. Ooh, this is serious. Then the demon rose up to the six heavens, to the realm of desire, and spoke to the celestial beings. So you know there are six realms. In the desire realms, the celestial realms, the way you get into those realms is that you have a lot of good karma, but the problem is that all the time you're experiencing this lovely life with absolutely no troubles, you're using up all this merit. And then what happens when you use up your merit is back into the human realm. So he spoke to these celestial beings, and he also visited the Brahma heavens and sought deliverance. So, you know, the Brahman gods were very close to Buddha in the early Pali Canon. They're around a lot, and they talk to the Buddha and encourage him. So the celestial being said, "This is a supernatural transformation done by a disciple of the Buddha who has the 10 powers. We are rather ordinary beings. So what can we do about it?" The demon said, "Well, then what can I do if I can't get recourse from you guys?" The Brahman celestials told him to take refuge with Uptagupta, and then he would be able to get rid of the garland. So basically they're saying, you know, you've got to go back to Uptagupta. He's the one who put it around your neck. You have to go make peace with him. So these Brahman gods, they recited a verse to him in order to change his mind about going to see Uptagupta. They said, "If you fall down because of the ground, you must use the ground to get up. If you try to get up without the ground, it makes no sense." And then they said, "Return and seek liberation from a disciple with the 10 powers." Having received this instruction, the demon left the celestial mansion and in repentance paid homage at the feet of the venerable Uptagupta. The venerable asked him, "Are you going to ever try to harm the Tathagata's true Dharma?" The demon replied, "I completely take refuge in the Buddha way and will forever cease what is not good." The venerable said, "In that case, you must say that you take refuge in the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha." The demon king joined his hands and pronounced the refuge formula three times, and the garland fell off. So that's the story. By the way, when you say something three times in Buddhism, like the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, we do the refuges, we always do them three times. And that makes it a kind of vow. It's almost a contract that you can't break. So there are other stories where people do things like that, and then they go off and do bad things, but in their next lifetime they're a monk or something like that. So it has this real power attached to it. Okay, so that's the story. Let's take a look at the story and see what we can make of it. All right, so Uptagupta would enter samadhi, and the demon would watch, and he was jealous. So if we think about the demon, if we think about this from the perspective of all beings are Buddha nature, that everything is engaged in this activity, which is essentially an altruistic activity of the bodhisattva path of making the world, even in the total midst of our delusion, that is how things are essentially. So the demon's essential nature is Buddha nature. So the demon is watching Uptagupta, and he thinks that he's angry, but actually what it is it's that part of us that wants to connect. It's that part of us that has this deep desire to be happy, this part of us that wants to alleviate our suffering. So although we don't know that that's true, there's something that attracts us to this, and I think that's what's happening here. So the demon is attracted to Uptagupta, even though in his mind, he's saying, "I'm jealous, I hate him, he's off doing samadhi, so I'm going to play a trick on him." So the trick on him is to offer him a garland. Garlands in Buddhism are their flower, kind of like leis, that are offered as homage, that you honor someone when you give them a garland. It's a kind of offering. It's a kind of devotional object. So in a way, Uptagupta is receiving this homage from the demon when he receives the garland. So it could be that Uptagupta, in his wisdom, said, oh, I can see that this demon actually wants to connect with his deeper self. He actually wants to connect with what Suzuki Roshi would call the inmost request, this inmost request that we have to wake up. So Uptagupta said, well, what can I do to facilitate this? What can I do to meet the demon on that being's terms, to meet the demon in a place that the demon will understand and will cause transformation within the demon? So what he did is he made this magical garland that was actually made up of these rotting corpses. Now, there's a story in the Lotus Sutra many of you are probably familiar with, which is the story of the burning house. And in the burning house, the kids are playing in a house that's infested with bugs. It's got termites. It's got all sorts of gross things crawling around in it, filled with mold, and it's on fire. And this house represents our Saha world. The house represents our suffering. The house represents the fact that we don't know that there's a problem. And so the kids are running around and they're playing and they don't want to leave the house. And the Buddha says to himself, how am I going to get these kids out of this house? And so what he does is he promises them gifts. So he appeals to their greed, essentially, and says, you know, I'm going to give you all this stuff, kids, if you'll leave the house. But you have got to come out to the courtyard in order to get this stuff. So the kids finally realize their greed overtakes them. They say, well, okay, we're going to go on the courtyard and get these three vehicles. Let's see there. A deer cart, an ox cart, and I can't remember the third one. But basically they represent the three schools of Buddhism. They represent the Arhat school, the school of the Pratyeka Buddha, and the school of the Buddha Bodhisattva school. So Buddha gets them out there in the courtyard, and actually there's only one cart there because this is a Mahayana Sutra, and the one cart is the Bodhisattva Buddha path. So in a way, Uptagupta is doing this kind of bait and switch thing. So Uptagupta, you know, brings the demon close. He whispers to him. He seduces him in a certain way and says, you know, I too will honor you. And in a way, that's exactly what happens when we work with our kind of more, you know, unskillful side. When we work with that side of ourselves that's suffering, it doesn't work to go to that side of ourselves and say, you are so bad. You are so bad. Like, you are so bad that you can't even go to this place. You know, there'll never be a chance for you to be able to be awakened. Instead, we say to ourselves, hopefully we have compassion towards ourselves. We say to ourselves, I recognize my goodness. I recognize my effort. I recognize this deeper desire that I have. And I can see that I'm unskillful. I can see that I need to work on this thing. But I also have this confidence in my inner ability to wake up. I'm not going to beat myself up in a way that's unproductive, because, of course, when we do that, we say, oh, forget about it. I don't want to do this. Who wants to do something that where you're constantly feeling bad about yourself? So Uptagupta goes and he says, you know, I've got this really beautiful garland. And he gives him the garland, and all of a sudden it turns into this really gross stuff. You know, a dead person, a dead dog, and a dead snake, and they're festering with insects and maggots and flies, like the inside of the burning house. So all of a sudden the demon wakes up, in a way, to samsara. He wakes up to this side of her that isn't working, right? We come to practice. I don't know about you, but when I came to practice, it's like I was low. There was a part of me that was attracted to practice because there was something about it that just attracted me to this practice. So in a way, maybe that's like Uptagupta, like the demon, you know, sitting and watching Uptagupta meditating and saying, oh, I really kind of want to do that thing. But he didn't really know what he was getting into. And then when you get into it, you realize, oh my gosh, I'm like wearing this garland of corpses and dead things and unhappiness and samsara and suffering. And then there's this Four Noble Truths that says there is suffering. I'm like, what do you mean there's suffering? Well, yeah, I guess there really is suffering, and I'm the one who's suffering and all of that stuff, right? So then we realize that there's a problem. But the other thing we're told is that there's a solution to the problem, and it's the practice that we're doing. But there is always, I think, this place where our selfishness, the part of ourself that is like a brat, right, is like the demon, the part of ourselves that just doesn't want to do this practice because it's hard. I don't want to apologize to that person. It's their fault, you know. I don't want to wait in traffic. I want to be the only person on the road, you know. Like, where are all these people going? So this way in which there's a brat inside of us that just is like very, very, very unhappy. And sometimes our suffering is a lot deeper than that. It's not just that kind of brat level, but there's this deep level of discomfort with being human beings in this world. There's this deep level of, you know, as we say in the old age, sickness, death, things changing and permanence, this deep having to come and meet that and how difficult that is. So this is where the demon is. You know, the garland turns into, he sees samsara. He sees his samsara and it's hanging around his neck. It's not somebody else's samsara, it's his samsara. And how painful that is. And what do? Often we're like, get this thing off of me. You know, if I can run fast enough, I can leave it behind. But it stuck to him. So he's completely distraught. So this flower garland is the awakened mind. So this flower garden that he's being offered by Uptagupta is this awakened mind. And yet we cannot awake without coming to terms with, without facing and being with the parts of ourselves that we don't like, the difficulties that we have. So the symbolism of the dog and the human and the snake is interesting. So in India, one way of talking about dogs is they're unclean. They're outcasts, stray dogs. So now at the same time, dogs can represent loyalty in India as well. So there's this way that this dead animal, this dead dog, is that kind of outcast side of ourselves. It's that feeling separate, that way in which we don't feel like we belong, and it's festering, and it's rotting, and it's creating a lot of suffering and unhappiness. And yet simultaneously, maybe there is some loyalty there in the midst of that as well. And then the snake can represent rebirth and death, because a snake sheds its skin. So the snake has an aspect that's very powerful in Buddhism of this rebirth and death. And it also appears in the wheel of birth and death, in the hub of the wheel and birth and death, it appears in the position of representing anger. So there's this way that snakes, when disturbed, are very fast to respond, poisonous snakes. And so this represents anger. So again, the snake kind of represents two sides here, this death and rebirth. And death and rebirth, from a Buddhist perspective, is not such a bad thing, but actually from the perspective of not liking impermanence, death is a very difficult thing for us. This constant death and renewal of our life, of situations, of our relationships, all of the things that represents. So a lot of Buddhism is about coming to terms with transforming our relationship with impermanence. And then I think the human being can just be a representation of delusion in general, samsara in general. So this is what the demon now has about his neck. In some ways, now he's completely burdened with the reality of his life. And yet simultaneously, the Buddha is there. Simultaneously, there is this Buddha nature. So I'll ask you a question. When you feel like you have done something that's really unskillful, where does the part of you that's very skillful, where has it gone? And when you do something that's very skillful, what happened to that part of you that does all sorts of wild and crazy unskillful things? So if you think about that, they're both simultaneously present. We want to always, you know, we would like to always bring forth the skillful side. But often when we do that, what that means is we want to deny the unskillful and act as if it doesn't exist. And when the unskillful side comes forward, if we beat ourselves up and act like, you know, that's the only thing that we are, then that's a problem. So how do we, you know, a lot of practice is like, how do we be with that? How do we be with this garland around our neck that can be both the garland of beautiful flowers and the garland of samsara? How do we do that? So our practice is an awful lot about how do we integrate and work with those two aspects of our experience. So we mistake samsara for nirvana, and we mistake nirvana, or our ideas of nirvana become samsara. So how do we work with that? Okay, so the demon, he goes up and visits the gods in the heavenly realms. And they said, well, you know, we can't help you because actually the power... Now, this is a Buddhist story, right? So it's a given that Buddhist power is going to be greater than anybody else's power. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a very good teaching story. He'd go up there to the Brahmins and say, hey, no problem. Go sit in the sauna, you'll be fine. No problem, have a few cookies, it'll all be okay. And often that's what we do, right? We're like, you know, I'm not saying, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Because we also have to acknowledge the fact that a few cookies are good and going to the sauna can be great. The question is that our only method of dealing with our problems? So anyway, he goes up to the heavenly realm, and they're like, sorry, we can't help you. So they say, you know, okay, you have to go and do this practice. You know that moment where you're like, oh, man, I can't believe I actually have to practice this stuff. You know? I remember studying Shantideva around working with anger when I was at Tassajara. And there was one time that this woman who I didn't like, they were having study at, we were having a study period in the morning. Everybody's in the dining room studying, very quiet, right? She and I are out on the path to Tassajara outside the dining room going, you know, back and forth at each other, right? Everybody can hear us. So it's like, I'm like, what's wrong with this picture? You know? So somebody comes out and tells us to be quiet. So we both go back in the dining room and study, but I'm trying to work with myself and like get over it, you know, get over this. But there, you know, there's that part of you that's like, but it's their fault. It's their fault. And you say, why don't you practice compassion? Why don't you consider the possibility there might be some causes and conditions for why they're like, I'm sorry, it's their fault. No, actually, let's think about, you know, so you like talk to yourself about practice. You say, well, you know, the practice is this. And the other side of you goes, no, it's not. I'm going to blame them. I don't care what the practice is. And you say, it's okay. Take a deep breath. Let's go back and talk about what the practice is. And so in a way, it's like this negotiating with yourself. And then your deepest desire, essentially not to suffer, comes forward and says, okay, I'm actually going to do this practice. I'm going to get up in the morning and go to Zazen. That's a great part of being the monastery. It's like you have no option. If you don't get up in the morning, the tankard comes and knocks on your door. Why aren't you at Zazen right now? Are you sick? Can I bring you something? I'll bring you your food. It's kind of like when you get sick and your mom said, well, okay, you can stay home from school, but at 3 o'clock when you say, hey, I want to go and play with my friends. Like, no, you stayed home from school today. Remember, you're sick. So this demon is really resisting and fighting doing this practice. He's running all over the place trying to find some other way to deal with this problem that he has. So he goes back to Uptagupa. Oh, I was going to talk about... Okay, so the demons recite this verse. If you fall down because of the ground, you must use the ground to get up. So the ground is... The ground is our everyday life, right? But the ground is also the foundation of reality itself. So when we fall down because of the ground, from a relative point of view, if you fall down on the ground, the only way you can get up is to push up off the ground or push up off something that's attached to the ground. From a Buddhist point of view, the only way that you can get up is by practicing the Dharma. The only way that you can get up is by realizing the foundational practice of the Bodhisattva way, by realizing that we are all in this interconnected relationship in which while there is a self, there is simultaneously no self. So this way that we have to get up from the ground. So the demons are saying, you have to go and do this practice. You have to practice. So if you fall down because of the ground, you must use the ground to get up. If you try to get up without the ground, Cook says it makes no sense. I would say it's absurd, right? You cannot get up off the ground without using the ground in some way. It's just not possible. So there's this way in which the only way that we can get up from our problems, the only way that we can work with suffering is to work with suffering. The only way that we can get up from our problems is to work with our problems and use our problems to get up off the ground. And yet, at the same time, there is this deep foundational way that we understand the nature of reality, which incorporates, is not separate from problems, and yet is more than problems, right? It is bigger than problems. So how we understand that. So that's what the Brahmins are saying to the demon, that you have to go back to Uptagupta and you have to learn about this practice. So he goes back to Uptagupta, and a little ahead of myself, he says, you have to do this. He said, you have to do this. Oh, return and seek liberation from the disciple with the 10 powers. So what are the 10 powers? So I looked them up last night, and I thought it was kind of interesting. Because these 10 powers are all powers that are within the capacity of us to practice in our human life. So here they are. The power of reflection, that we reflect on the nature of our experience. The power of aspiration, that we wake up that innate desire of the inmost request. And that is Uptagupta putting the garland. That is the demon putting the garland around Uptagupta's neck, is this aspiration. Even though we may not, and you know, these, all of these things kind of happen simultaneously. So they're not like stages. They're more like a 10-lane freeway that you're negotiating. So this power of reflection, the power of aspiration, and then the power of application. We have to apply the practice. We cannot do the practice without actually doing the practice. We have to use the ground to get up from the ground. That's kind of a sticking point. That's actually quite difficult. So that we engage in that. The power of wisdom. This wisdom means that everything is interconnected relationship. Everything is interpenetrating. This is wisdom and compassion. When we know that, when we can engage that truth, then we are compassionate. We have empathy for each other. We see more of our sameness rather than our differences. The power of vow. Vow is very powerful. And it exists in the story. The vow of taking the three treasures. The vow of saying, I take refuge in Buddha, which is my own Buddha, Buddha-ness, my own Buddha nature, your Buddha nature, our Buddha nature, and also the example of Shakyamuni Buddha himself, herself, Shakyamuni Buddha, as all the Buddhas and ancestors. So this way that we take this refuge in Dharma, which is the teaching. This is the ground that gets us off the ground. The Dharma also, that's big D Dharma, teaching. The little D Dharma means things themselves. So we live in a concrete world filled with things. We are a thing. This itness of the world. There is a koan that says, what is it? What is it? The answer is, what is it? So that question, answer all the time, that simultaneity of this form realm, of pushing up, being part of, not separate from. What is it? What is it? What is it? It is what? What is it? The power of the vehicle, which is the bodhisattva path, which is the path that we engage in. The power of conduct. So how do we actually act? How do we actually respond? The power of transformation, that we are capable of transformation. Fall down, gets up. It's a Japanese expression. Falls down 7 times, gets up 8. So that's what we're being asked to do. Fall down 7 times, get up 8. So get up 8, fall, you know, all the time. Because that's what it's like to be a human being. Fall down, get up. The power of enlightenment. The power of enlightenment. We engage in enlightened behavior all the time. We are doing things all the time. But because we have an exalted, rather unrealistic view of what that might be, we don't see that in ourselves and see it in others. Every time we engage in an act of kindness, every time we exhibit patience, every time that we're empathic to each other, every time that we're helpful and skillful, that is an enlightened response. And we do that a lot more than we think we do. And so do other people. So we all have this power of the enlightened response. And then the power of turning the wheel of the Dharma. So turning the wheel of the Dharma is not just about teaching somebody else about the Dharma, and I would say that that's the least of what we need to worry about. It is actually engaging and enacting the Dharma. So it's not a pedantic activity. It's the activity of actually doing the practice. So these are the things that are these 10 magical powers that Uptagupta had that the demon did not. These are the 10 magical powers that Uptagupta was able to free the demon from the necklace, but actually the demon frees the demon from the necklace. As soon as we acknowledge, and from a Buddhist perspective, as soon as we acknowledge and take up this vow, we are freed. From the perspective of non-duality, we are always free. We are never not free. What keeps us from the freedom is the fact that we don't realize the truth of the freedom itself always functioning, because that is reality itself. And so reality itself is not not. So we are always, it is always available to us. And that's why we have enlightened response as well, because it's like, bang, enlightened response, bang, enlightened response, because it's not something separate from us. It is just this willingness to, at that moment, to go array oneself with the totality of your situation, and then it falls apart, right? And then each moment is that possibility. Each moment is that moment of enlightenment. Each moment is the garland turning into a flower garland. And then the flower garland turns into this stinky mess. And then it turns back to the flower garland. But that vow that we make, the willingness to keep coming back, that's our practice. Dogen says, practice realization. Realization happens in practice. It does not happen separate. We do not practice to become realized. We don't practice to get rid of the garland. The garland, as both good and bad, there's something beyond that which is just the dignified behavior of a Buddha, just engaging in practice realization. I say just. The just is not like, hey, it's simple. The just is this, what is this in this moment? And then as soon as the demon realized that, it was, well, probably long hours of zazen. Reading the scriptures, studying, practicing. So this is a story of Upta Gupta and the demon. Thank you. Thank you very much.